This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, it is 9 o'clock here on the West Coast, and already midnight there on the East Coast at WBAI in New York City and WPFW in Washington, D.C. Houston, you're in the house. It is 11 p.m., if I remember my time zones correctly, and 9 o'clock here in Los Angeles and up there in KPFA in Berkeley. Thank you so much, Chris Welch and Stephanie Hendricks. What a wonderful thing to listen to Bernice and talk about Mary Makeba. And really, and again, the shout-out to Odetta. Thank you so much for giving this broadcast today. Almost 16 hours. We're in our 15th hour now, and it really gave us the heart and soul of what this is all about. You know, we had the recording, this live, rare recording of Mary Makeba in the...
Okay, well, with that, as you just heard, it's 9 o'clock on the West Coast, which means that it's midnight here on the East Coast. So, we after that special from the Pacifica Archives, we return you live to the studios of WBAI, 99.5 FM here in La Manzana Grande, which means that without further ado, it's time for this. Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Anarchism for the global city. Radical environmentalism for the concrete jungle. Esoteric explorations of the secret history of rebel culture. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM.
Thank you. get the dead. Wapanam hen, get alam, sim army wad hen, lige yang wala gwalam, yuma hal pular, baba hal pular, sain kung gwanda kotan gwanta sular, wasinam dade dagnu kui de yola de, anu yima dem galam, mate bibe leitam, bawa naftor de jimdam, wasi wan tu de wan noka fundu dem galam, met dem gal watwe, kono jabi hang, galumina fore makal, anu mi umo nongal, anu mi jaro nongal, lo jai si duni, anu mi umo nongal, anu mi jaro nongal, no baba mal nigga, kalama anda lenyol mum adamum on ko humane pindo muko suko antagi adena upo ko fati lenyol ana anda ko fati ada ana yida hay sa janki awawata
balen na fuka be de ko dari be ngam dalitar le jam mori khania usman gange tamini mo bismillah mo jamen deki bismillah
em ga pular ummi muini gele mi pamdis mi kala dum tan wi ko kodi ko minene ko wi alam yitte dem galam timmi dum ko ha e der berndam sum haali dogara ha e der pandam ko buru muzo ko to elle dem ga pa ko joni joli kalmo bida hal dem ga pular te ko tummi nay ma toni mar hal de dem gal munde boni ha de dem gal mu bonani say yidi ko kew o meti jani an yidi ko no won ko wopi wa alla yurmo mu yafo gumina den ne dem gal mede no umri no ngal cengen gal cengrene magal ba fe ta dem magal se chenti me magal ke hedo be chagal mata anda dem galam kanyu woni galam sum hala dinta jalam felam felam
eliman samoru barka ya la yurbo ya fobo wala li may lawol jerande lawol ci bobe lawolay nabe ya ha
Continuing in our West African groove here on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. On listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City, where I am Bill Weinberg. And we were opening up at the top there with a cut from The Rough Guide to the Music of Mali from the Rough Guide series, as the name would imply. And that artist was Basaku Koyate, playing the goni, or the West African lute, in a very traditional style, and then immediately followed by some more from Jam Min Teki, the Mauritanian rap group, which whose disc was laid on us by our good friend Abdurrahman Wone, who we had on these airwaves last week. And they also started out in a sort of traditional style there, but then they got the electronic and hip-hop thing going on. So if anybody out there understands Fulani, maybe they can call in later on and tell us what Jam Min Teki was rapping about in that tune. And, well, let's see. We'll be delving more into these discs later tonight. I do have a few things I would like to talk about. And maybe if people want to weigh in later, we'll consider taking some listener phone calls. I don't have any, and I wasn't able to find any of Miriam Makeba's music. But every other producer here at WBAI has been paying homage to her, so I don't feel like I'm too remiss in my duties to the listeners. But I would like to bid a fond farewell to Miriam Makeba, especially given that not too many of the homages have mentioned here at BAI the circumstances of her death. She died in a concert immediately after a concert, immediately after performing. She took ill at the town of Castelvolturno, which is outside of Naples in southern Italy, where she was performing at a concert in solidarity with Roberto Saviano, who is an Italian journalist who has been threatened with death for a book he wrote, which was an expose of the Camorra, or the crime machine that runs Naples. And this was a concert in support of him and to raise money for his efforts, and to basically have a public show of support of him in defiance of the Naples crime machine, which has publicly marked him for death. And the town of Castelvolturno was also the scene of a rather brutal killing just a few weeks ago of several African immigrants in its circumstances which are still murky, actually, but it was almost certainly a Camorra hit. And it's suspected that they might have fallen afoul of some Camorra-controlled drug gangs one way or another. But there's been a whole spate, actually, of racist attacks across Italy in recent weeks, particularly since the election to office once again of now for what, his third term, although not third consecutive term, of Berlusconi and his right-wing alliance partners. And a lot of this just seems to be sheer xenophobic attacks on both African immigrants and Romani immigrants from Eastern Europe, so-called gypsies, to use the inaccurate and derogatory term. Some of them quite violent attacks, including in the town of Naples. Gypsy camps have been burned down in the what are essentially the shanty towns on the outskirts of Naples. So in Naples in particular, there seems to be a sort of a convergence of the Camorra reign of terror and the xenophobic violence, which is at least sort of unofficially encouraged by the climate which has been propagated by the Berlusconi administration, which has made a very, very big deal of cracking down on so-called illegal immigrants and particularly on the Romani. And in fact, there's been a lot of controversy about the subjecting a program which the Berlusconi administration has put in place, in which all of the Romani are being fingerprinted and they have to show up at police stations for identity checks and all of this sort of thing, merely on the basis of their ethnicity. Very, very sinister. So this is not happening in some third world country or some former communist dictatorship. This is happening in Italy, G8 member, NATO member and everything, right? Very, very, very ominous stuff. So once again, hail and farewell, Miriam Makeba, who I'm pleased to note in her what will be remembered by history as her final performance. She was acting in solidarity with my peeps, the long-suffering and proud people of southern Italy. So thank you, and hail and farewell, Miriam Makeba. And, you know, actually, for the rest of the show, I'd like to bring our attention back to these shores, but unfortunately, on some of some similar themes to what I was just discussing in Italy. Some rather ominous developments which have been in the news lately, as everybody has been in this, well, not everybody, which is kind of to the point, but certainly almost everybody who I've spoken to, apart from, you know, a few real hard-bitten, dyed-in-the-wool, ultra, shall we say, anarcho-syndicalists. There's sort of been this real sense of euphoria, of course, about the election results. But there have been some very ominous developments since Obama's election, which have not been hitting the front pages, but are nonetheless worthy of our attention. And so we'll be looking at that in just a few minutes. But before we move on to that, I do have one other thing which I need to get off my chest. And, well, you know, we've been talking a lot on these airwaves about the changing face of New York City and how small businesses and real, you know, neighborhood-rooted businesses and institutions and those which cater to the working class and immigrants are being pushed out in the development blitz. And particularly, we've been talking about the changing culinary face of New York City and how it's getting harder and harder to find good food, good, unpretentious, working-class fare, and, you know, an ethno-grub, as we might call it, here in New York City. And, you know, everything is becoming either fast food chains, whether of the real bottom-of-the-barrel type like, you know, McDonald's and KFC, or the more, you know, slightly upscale or pretentious, but still fast food chains like Starbucks or Chipotle Grill, which is owned by the McDonald's Corporation, by the way. It's either that. It's either the fast food chains or it's, you know, nose in your air, your nose in the air, yuppie cuisine, you know, hout cuisine, where everything is very overpriced and pretentious and tiny little portions and, you know, not like real food, right? So it's the middle places which are being pushed out, you know, as you've heard me ranting before, the places which are inexpensive and yet are giving you real food, okay, and real ethnic food brought by people from the old country. You know, really doing it the old style way. Well, another one of my favorite places, I'm afraid, has disappeared. And it's one which the listeners will be familiar with because they were my good buds over at a place just known as Hot Bagels, which is on 203 East Houston Street between Orchard and Ludlow, which is run by Jewish immigrants from Turkmenistan. And they have laid wonderful music on me for this radio show, because whenever I go in there, they've got some great sort of, you know, ethno-pop music playing from Central Asia or the Caucasus. And, you know, I've asked them about the music, and, you know, they've actually laid CDs on me. Wonderful stuff. People playing, like similarly, just like we heard Jamin Teki from Mauritania kind of mixing up the traditional West African vibe with the, you know, techno-electronica thing. Similarly, a lot of this music that I've got from my friends at Hot Bagels is, you know, they've got the Zordana and all the, you know, traditional instruments of the Caucasus and Central Asia, but they mix it up with this sort of electronic beat, and it's absolutely irresistible stuff. And you people who have heard it over these airwaves will know what I'm talking about, because we've played it on these airwaves, and it's just absolutely irresistible, just like that Jam Minteki stuff from Mauritania in West Africa, the similar stuff that we've played from Armenia and Azerbaijan and Uzbekistan and Russia, that we've picked up from our friends at Hot Bagels. A similarly irresistible and in a similar sort of way, even though it's from a very different part of the world. So, although it has got, I would argue, the same sort of Moorish theme running through it, right? Because, I mean, they sort of are on both on the far extremities of what was once the, the Abbasid Caliphate, and certainly, you know, on the far extremities of the Islamic world. So, although my buds at Hot Bagels happen to be Jewish, and are they still there? Particularly Sasha, my good friend Sasha. If you are listening tonight, or if anybody who knows how to reach Sasha from Hot Bagels at 203 East Houston Street, please contact the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade and let me know, because, you know, I go down there to get my bagel with a schmear and coffee in the morning, or I should say in the afternoon, because I usually don't wake up until the sun is pretty high in the sky, because I'm a night owl, but which comes from doing this radio show for 20 years. But, you know, I'd say at least, you know, once or twice a week, I hop on my bike and I go down there to get my bagel and coffee. And they have really, really good fresh bagels, as well as they've also got pizza. So they got both sides of my ethnic heritage going on, my Jewish and my Italian side. And in addition to which, you know, they had, I've actually got their menu in front of me. You know, they made homemade soups, and they had, humantaschen and rugula and all that good stuff. And they really seem to, even though it's very simple fare, you know, they really take some pride in its presentation, and they're always, you know, plying me to try their latest. They've even got like these sort of exotic turnovers stuffed with garlicky potatoes and whatnot. I'm not quite sure exactly what it's called. But, you know, real Central Asian delicacies, real McCoy stuff, right? So, where are they? The past few days I've gone down there to get my bagel, or a few days ago I went down there to get my bagel and it was closed. And in fact, it happened to be Veterans Day. So I was thinking to myself, maybe it's just Veterans Day, right? So I came back the next day and it was still closed. And I've gone back a couple of times since then, and the gate is down, it's closed, everything. I tried the call, and the number's been disconnected, so I never had any warning or anything. I feel like I've been kicked in the gut. I really do. I feel like I've been kicked in the gut. You know, the irony is that, you know, I'm on the Lower East Side, which used to be like, you know, the capital of Jewish culture in America, and there isn't going to be any place left in the neighborhood to get a good, authentic bagel. I mean, there's still Kazar's Bialy's down on Grand Street, but that's not like a place where you can actually sit down. You can just get your Bialy's to go there. And in fact, I think that the Bialy's that they sold at Hot Bagels were actually made a few blocks to the south at Kazar's Bialy's. But, there isn't going to be like a place where you can actually sit down and get a bagel with a schmear in the Lower East Side anymore. I mean, this is a disaster. All right, I shouldn't overstate the case. There's still one or two left, but that place was my favorite, and now there's one less. So, and in addition, they were friends of mine, and they had really good music, and it was kind of like, you know, it sort of felt like a family scene eating there. It really did. And I feel like I've been kicked in the gut. If that place is gone, it's like one more nail in this city's coffin. So if anybody can help me out here in tracking down Sasha and the crew from Hot Bagels at 203 East Houston Street, you know, I hope they haven't closed. I hope they're just on vacation or something. And I'd like to stay in touch with you guys anyway, because you gave me really great music in addition to really great food. So if anybody can help me find Sasha and the crew from Hot Bagels at 203 Houston Street, please call my voicemail, 212-631-1115, 212-631-1115. I'm going to give that number one more time, 212-631-1115. 5. Or you can write me here at WBAI, just me, Bill Weinberg, W-E-I-N-B-E-R-G, care of WBAI, and the address is 120 Wall Street, 10th floor, New York, New York, 10005. That's 120 Wall Street, 10th floor, New York, New York, 10005. So, I don't know. I mean, to me, this is just disastrous to me. Every time this happens, one of my favorite eateries close, and I just feel like I've just lost a part of me. You know, I feel like somebody's cut off one of my fingers. You know, I felt the same way when my favorite neighborhood Italian restaurant, La Focacceria, closed. You know, it's just, it's terrible. We're losing New York City so fast. And I was hoping that maybe the economic downturn would slow down the development blitz. And maybe it will. But it's kind of a double-edged sword. Because as we all know, under capitalism, you know, you're damned either way. You know, in the so-called boom times, in the so-called good times, in the boom times, you know, you've got the development blitz, which is forcing out all of the family-owned businesses. And then in the bad times, well, those family-owned businesses, which were already marginal thanks to the boom, are, you know, going to be the first to feel the pinch and go under. So I hope that isn't what happened to my good friends at Hot Bagels. So, okay, I'm sorry I've gone on for so long about Hot Bagels, okay, but I'm quite genuinely upset, as you can tell. All right, it's mere seconds of 12:30 in the morning here on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Bill Weinberg. And tell you what, let's hear a little bit more music from West Africa. Let's go back to the Rough Guide to the music of Mali. Why don't we hear a little bit of Rokia Traore? Why don't we do that?
Anganda que tu beta.
Well, there, some more music from The Rough Guide to the Music of Mali. That was Rokia Traore singing something appropriately somber for how I feel upon the loss of my favorite bagel joint. And by the way, those Turkish sort of stuffed dumpling type things, I was trying to remember the name of, they're called borekas. Of course. They had great burekas there. They had special pumpkin burekas this year for Halloween. And now they're gone. Anyway. So, all right. Enough about that. Let's move on. Okay. So, there's, as I say, there's sort of been a general atmosphere of euphoria. And it's sort of, it's been amazing how quickly, the general mood of the country has turned around from near despair just a few weeks ago to one of a real, seems to be this real sense of national unity and optimism, and everybody's making all these analogies to the election of JFK back in 1960. And, well, there are, I understand certainly the my anarcho-syndicalist friends who are warning about the dangers of co-optation of the progressive forces in this country by the Democratic Party. And, you know, I just sort of wish that there were more progressive forces to co-opt. You know, I'd be more concerned about that if I really felt that there were serious progressive forces out there in danger of being co-opted. But I'm hoping that maybe it'll go the other way, and that maybe, you know, a sense of hope for a change, and a sense that the sort of Reagan ideological consensus has finally been overturned in this country will actually lead to the emergence of some progressive movements at long last, because we really haven't seen too many of any strength or power in recent years. And I understand also the fears that Obama, simply because people are going to cut him slack, progressives are going to cut him slack, will be able to get away with things which a Republican president couldn't necessarily get away with. And certainly we saw that with Clinton, who got us into NAFTA and the World Trade Organization and several foreign military adventures. While at the same time he was being, relentlessly liberal baited and communist baited by the Gingrich right in this country. And I'm aware of that as well. And certainly, there have been some ominous signs, most particularly, today we just found out that Obama is going to be choosing Hillary Clinton as his Secretary of State. And, that's not a good sign. And his choice of Rahm Emanuel as Chief of Staff is also not a good sign. Especially given that, at a minimum, we had hoped that Obama was going to represent a break with the neocons. And certainly Rahm Emanuel would appear to be forthrightly in the neocon corner. So these are in some ways signs which bode poorly. But on the other hand, a lot of people have made the point that he may be trying to get started according to the old maxim of keeping your friends close and your enemies closer, and keeping potential rivals on his side rather than in opposition. So as to, actually be able to put his program into place. And a lot of people are making analogies to Lincoln strategies, where he did essentially the same thing in assembling his own cabinet, most notoriously, of course, with his second-term vice president, Andrew Johnson, who was a Southern Democrat. And, the Democrats at that time were the party of slavery. And Andrew Johnson was seen as, that element of Lincoln's cabinet, which represented, his political rivals. Obviously, Johnson wasn't with the Confederacy. He was anti-secessionist. But apart from that, he was, he was a Southern Democrat. So, a lot of people are sort of making this analogy. There's a book which I intend to read, which everybody's talking about, Team of Rivals, which is about the Lincoln cabinet, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln by Doris Kearns Goodwin. I'm going to make an effort to read this book by the end of the year, because a lot of people are pointing to Lincoln's strategies here as a model for Obama. And, my hope is that Obama will be able to rebuild a sense of national unity. Not that I necessarily believe in this entity called the United States of America, or think that national unity is necessarily a good thing, but something good could come out of it, which is because rebuilding a sense of national unity could be, redefine the sort of social consensus in this country, just as it was redefined by the Reagan Revolution in 1980, and just as before that it was redefined by FDR and the New Deal in 1932. And the only way that he'll be able to do that is by wooing the more pragmatic elements of even the Republican Party over to his side, and thereby alienating the Christian right, and significantly sidelining the neocons from their hegemonic role in foreign policy in this country over the past eight years of the Bush administration. So if he manages to pull this off, then the spectrum of what's considered legitimate debate in this country will change. And then, you know, I mean, you get a very skewed sense of what the world is like when you're a, you know, a lefty in New York City. You know, you get out there on the other side of the Hudson River and you'll quickly be disabused of any illusions which you might hold that, you know, things like socialism are actually in the political vocabulary, right? I mean, it's only an epithet which they throw, which the right throws around at people who are not even anywhere close to being socialist, such as Barack Obama, right? Or even Bill Clinton. So, if the political spectrum does begin to move back towards what used to be the center before the Reagan Revolution, then, you know, maybe eventually, because I don't think that Obama is going to move things to the left. He's going to move things towards the left, if you understand the distinction that I'm making, right? And he's going to be very pragmatic and very gradualist about it, I believe. But nonetheless, the final result could be that at least it'll be possible to talk maybe a few years down the line in mainstream American politics about not, you know, opportunity, which is the current Obama code word, so to speak, but unapologetic socialism, okay? Actually talking about public control of the means of production. And not just talking about, you know, a rescue for the middle class, which is, once again, the Obama rhetoric, but actually talk about justice for the poor, okay, which is a rather different concept, and Obama is quite pointedly not embracing this kind of rhetoric. So, but nonetheless, I've got a guarded sense of optimism, and I, you know, I have to say that despite being, you know, the hard-bitten anarchist that I always thought that I was, I shared in the euphoria on election night. But there were also some more ominous things which happened election night, which we're going to discuss. But fundamentally, just as one more word of prelude before we move on to some rather disturbing things which have been in the news since the election, the more fundamental thing, okay, even putting apart what Obama's actual program is going to be and whether or not he's going to be successful in implementing it. And certainly he's going to be looking at, you know, the most challenging situation that any president has faced in this country since FDR. But the more fundamental thing is that with the particularly Sarah Palin and also, you know, John McCain, but especially Sarah Palin, you know, just abjectly playing to the lowest common denominator, to overt racism, to anti-urbanism, anti-intellectualism, just proudly playing to the ugliest aspects of ugly America. This this election was sort of a it was sort of a referendum on racism and stupidity. And racism and stupidity lost. That's what really gives me hope about it. You know? So this raises the question of, you know, all of these people were who were showing up at the Palin Dog and Pony Show. They were, you could just see if you watched any of the videos on YouTube, you know, they were salivating at the prospect of genuinely taking power. They could smell power. And, yeah, we think that those people have been in power ever since Reagan. But in reality, they haven't. They haven't been in power. They've just been played by the people who are in power. They've been exploited and used as demographic cannon fodder and cannon fodder at the voting booth by the people who have been really running the country ever since Reagan. And now, and in fact, you know, there was something of a falling out, in fact, between the sort of, you know, the rural grassroots right and the Reagan coalition beginning with Poppy Bush, who, of course, notoriously coined the phrase New World Order, which became the buzzword for the radical right. And then with the election of Clinton, a lot of them started arming and forming these militias and so on, culminating ultimately in Oklahoma City. So there was once again this sense of national unity in a really, really bad sense after 9/11. To a certain extent, they sort of felt like they had their guy in. And I think, they actually liked W better than they liked Poppy, because W reminded them more of Reagan, who they felt like was really their man. But still, there was a sense that it was really, these neocons and blue bloods and trilateralist puppets and blah, 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 who were really running the show in Washington. And with Sarah Palin, they finally felt that they had one of their own, right? Because even W. Bush, even as stupid as he came across, and even though he grew up in Texas, he was actually from, he was born in Connecticut, and he was from blue blood stock, right? And they knew that, right? Whereas Sarah Palin was one of theirs and could really play to them as the real McCoy in a way which W. Bush never could. He could make a pretty good shot at it, but he couldn't quite pull it off with the same degree of authenticity as Sarah Palin. So they really smelled power. They really felt like, this is it. If our guys get in, then, McCain was from the more, always comes across as a maverick and blah, blah, blah. He was from the, that element of the Republican Party, which is a little bit more distanced from that whole agenda. But, he sold out. He sold his soul to the devil when he picked Palin as his running mate. And then Palin herself sort of took the ball and ran with it and sort of went unilateral. And notoriously, there were all of these tensions between the McCain and the Palin camp. But the grassroots Christian right in this country, particularly the Christian right, which kind of overlaps with the racist right, and just generally the anti-urban and the anti-intellectual right, which are sort of these overlapping spheres, somewhat distinct but also overlapping. They all felt, with the Christian right in the lead, that this was finally their day, and they were really going to be in power if these guys won. Well, they didn't win, and in fact, it was a resounding victory for the other team. And now the Republican Party generally, and the real hardcore Christian right element, they're in total disarray. They've been smashed to, overnight, they've just been smashed to the smithereens. And they have no direction. They're leaderless. They're rudderless. And they're going to have to figure out what their new strategy is going to be. And now let's talk about some things which have been in the news. Amidst all of the euphoria on election night, there were a few things which were little noticed, and one of them only made the New York Times on November 17th, which was yesterday. The headline on the front page of the National section, page A11, "A Time of Hope Marred by an Act of Horror," about an African-American church which was being constructed in Massachusetts, of all places, particularly ominous, in Massachusetts, in New England, not in the South. The caption to the photo of the gutted building reads, "The burned shell of the Macedonia Church of God in Christ, the future home of a mostly black congregation in Springfield, Massachusetts. After the structure was destroyed by arsonists in the early morning hours after the election, construction of the church was only 75% finished." And there's also a photo of Bishop Bryant Robinson Jr., who says that he could not shake the timing of the fire. And yeah, I'd say we'd be pretty hard pressed to believe that this was a coincidence. And let's see. Also, how many of you out there caught this on election night as spontaneous celebrations of Obama's victory were breaking out all over New York City? On Staten Island, a Liberian immigrant by the name of Ali Kamara, 17 years old, was brutally beaten by four white men armed with baseball bats who screamed Obama at him near his home in the Stapleton district of Staten Island as they beat him. Kamara, a Muslim whose family arrived in the year 2000, was returning home at around 11 p.m. when the men jumped out of a car and assaulted him. He was left with a head injury which required staples. Our hate crime task force is investigating and treating this as a possible bias crime, said Police Commissioner Ray Kelly. Possible bias crime? I would say it's pretty clearly a bias crime. Okay. And then there's also a quote from Aliyah Latif, the civil rights director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, New York chapter, which is calling for an FBI probe of the incident. He said, this incident should be of great concern to all Americans, not only because of the apparent bias motive, but because of its possible negative impact on equal participation in the political process. Yeah, I'd say. All right, then there was a almost immediately after Election Day, on November 7th, there was a story in the New York Times about a sudden surge of gun sales across rural America, which was explicitly seen as a response to the election of Barack Obama, and the National Rifle Association has been issuing all this propaganda, which has been fueling the flames. And they interview all of these sellers and purchasers at gun shops out there in middle America and places like Denver, Colorado, and so on, saying things like, Obama's a gun snatcher. He's going to come for our guns and create a socialist society policed by his own police force, blah, 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 blah. And the NRA, meanwhile, if you go to the NRA website, there's a post-election statement from their president, Wayne LaPierre, saying, what they didn't tell you today. It's not a matter of figuring out if Obama is anti-gun or not. We already know he is. What we're looking for now are signs of how aggressive he will be in trying to enact his gun control policies. So quite consciously fanning the flames of all these people out there who are stockpiling guns in preparation for I don't know what. Now, at the moment, as we say, you know, sort of the silver lining on the cloud is, you know, I mean, of course, that, you know, due to the election, the organized right has really been smashed into 1,000 pieces. But they could start to regroup. They could start to regroup, and the things which are already sort of spontaneously happening at the grassroots, I would say, are ominous. And meanwhile, we were alerted by our once in future co-producer here at the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, Bob McGill, who's down in real America, in Virginia, listening to right-wing talk radio, that Sean Hannity has been actually broaching on his nationally syndicated radio show the possibility of forming a quote-unquote conservative underground in response to Obama's election. And I should emphasize that, of course, Bob McGill just listens to right-wing talk radio as a sort of a hobby and to see what those people are up to. Not that he goes along with this stuff. He just finds it perversely amusing. I don't know. I find it more perverse than amusing myself. But so I did some poking around to see what Hannity is up to, and it turns out that he's promoting a series of Freedom Concerts 09. He's going on tour to spread the anti-Obama gospel with Lee Greenwood, the country and western singer who wrote that horrifically awful song about I'm proud to be an American, so at least I know I'm free. And, you know, that song, by the way, really sums up everything about what is wrong with the grassroots right in this country, and how they've really been bamboozled. Because if you listen to the lyrics, you know, there's one lyric, how does it go? Maybe I should search for the lyrics online, but it's something like, you know what I'm going to do? When we take another musical break, I'm going to search for those lyrics online because it's extremely illustrative, extremely illustrative. But okay, while I do that, before I do that, let me keep going here. Who else is going to be at the Sean Hannity Freedom Concerts 09? Billy Ray Cyrus, another country western singer, and Charlie Daniels. I really feel a little bit betrayed there because I kind of liked Charlie Daniels. I'm ashamed to admit, back in the 1980s, and he was actually a cut above all of that horrific southern rock, which was inundating the airways back then. He was more actually, you know, steeped in bluegrass and more authentic. He sort of had this populist appeal even then, but that was before he really showed his cards as a right winger, which he did when Reagan was elected. So, but now he's like really gone overboard, and he's, well, you know, he's getting old. Maybe he's beginning to lose it. I hate to sound ageist, but anyway, so he's on board, and who else is on board? Of course, Oliver North is on board. So there you go, Lee Greenwood, Charlie Daniels, and Oliver North are going to be on tour with Sean Hannity promoting the anti-Obama Freedom Concerts 09 at the same time that Hannity is talking on his radio show about forming a conservative underground, quote, unquote. All right. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. Here on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Bill Weinberg, and we're talking about some scary stuff tonight. And you know what? You know what I'm going to do? I have one more news clip to read, and then I'm going to play a little bit more music, and then maybe we'll consider taking some phone calls if anybody has anything to say. 212-209-2900. 212-209-2900. The final clip I'm going to read, continuing in this rather ominous theme, is, there was a favorable court ruling in Kentucky where the Imperial Clans of America, the local Ku Klux Klan outfit down there in Kentucky, is going to have to pay $2 million in compensatory and punitive damages for a racially motivated attack against a 16-year-old boy by the name of Jordan Groover, who is of Panamanian descent and who was attacked by Imperial Wizard Ron Edwards and his goons at a country fair in Meade, Kentucky, where apparently there was a Klan recruitment drive going on. And it's pretty scary to think that in this day and age, the Klan can hold a recruitment drive openly at a country fair. Very, very scary. But what's even scarier is that they apparently thought that young Jordan Groover was, I guess just by looking at him, they could just tell, even though they were wrong, and he wasn't. He's a U.S. citizen, but they thought that he was a illegal alien, quote unquote. So they beat him up pretty bad, and he sued and he won, and he's going to get $2 million in damages. So that's a good thing. So just as soon as this case was resolved in favor of this youth, there's another case which just happened, in fact, just about the same day, in fact, just about a week earlier, actually, yeah, because the case was resolved November 14th, and then just a week before that, almost a week before that, November 8th, an Ecuadorian immigrant by the name of Marcelo Lucero was stabbed to death in Patchogue, Suffolk County, Long Island, New York. And seven teenagers have been arrested and charged in the attack, which police are calling a hate crime. What makes it particularly controversial is that the Suffolk County executive, Steve Levy, is coming under attack for having promoted an atmosphere of hate in the prelude to the attack through his hardline advocacy of a crackdown on so-called illegal immigrants. So just as we sort of opened this discussion with, the Berlusconi administration in Italy is doing this nationally, well, Steve Levy is doing the same thing in Suffolk County and is now being faced with some pretty heavy karma over it. So my fear is that, here in New York City, we're getting a skewed sense of things, even though real America, so to speak, or ugly America, is as close as Suffolk County and Staten Island. And my fear is, what is the anti-Obama backlash going to look like when finally the right begins to recongeal and reorganize after a period of licking its wounds? And I hope, of course, that it's not going to look like very much. And hopefully I'm just being alarmist and just being paranoid. And there might be, something to what the Hegelians call the paradoxical unity of opposites, and that it's actually going to take a black man in the Oval Office to win over the white working class and reforge a sense of national unity over a at least somewhat progressive agenda. But nonetheless, I do have a certain sense of foreboding. I'll have more to say about that shortly. Let's take another musical break, and then we'll consider taking some phone calls at 212-209-2900 if anybody has anything to say. Okay, why don't we hear some Ubo Sangare? Let's do that. That would be cut six, wouldn't it? Yes, it would. Thank you. Well, I'm sure glad that we're listening to Umo Sangare here in here at WBAI, and not Lee Greenwood. I found those lyrics. Here, I'm just going to rant a little bit, and then we'll have maybe 20 minutes to take phone calls if anybody calls in, but nobody's calling in. So, you know, you people are really funny. You're always prevailing upon me to take phone calls, and then you don't call. 212-209-2900 is the number. 212-209-2900. Am I just a paranoid freak? Am I just like, you know, being a gloomy Gus raining on everybody's parade? If you think so, then tell me where to get off. 212-209-2900. But first, let me just rant a little bit about those Lee Greenwood lyrics, because I found them on the web. And his big song, of course, is God Bless the USA. And the lyrics go, if tomorrow all the things were gone I'd worked for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife, I'd thank my lucky stars to be living here today, because the flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away. And, you know, that really says everything about the whole stupid and proud ethic, which was represented by the whole Sarah Palin roadshow, okay, for starters, and represented more generally by I hate to say it, the grassroots rural right in this country, which is much of grassroots rural America. And especially, it's especially poignant now where so many people are losing everything that they worked for all their lives, and their homes are being foreclosed. And instead of, like, you know, recognizing the right enemy, which is the capitalist class, and the banks and the people who really own the country, you know, instead they're suckered by the most maudlin, empty patriotism and this, you know, love of God and country, blah, 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 into being cannon fodder at the voting booth year after year after year after year for their own class enemies. Okay. And my real fear now is that, you know, this Obama is not going to be able to pull a rabbit out of his hat and immediately make the financial crisis go away. People are going to continue to lose their homes. And there's going to be a lot of angry people out there in rural America. And how is that anger going to be directed? And are we going to be looking at a reprise of what we saw when Clinton was in power in the 90s? With the militia movement? I certainly hope not. But let's see what you, the listeners, have to say, since now some people are calling in. We've got 20 minutes, so let's keep it rocking along. WBAI, you're on the air.
Oh, hello.
Turn down your radio and speak up.
Okay. All right. I don't think you're being paranoid in terms of wondering if the country's ready for Obama, because obviously it is a shock to some. But, you know, as an inauguration it comes closer, I think you're going to hear a lot more crazy stuff going on out there, unfortunately. But I suspect that, you know, hopefully people will wake up and realize that this is, you know, a time where you need somebody who knows, who seems to have clues as to what to do, because you just can't keep going the way we've been going the last 8 years. Just, you know, I don't think the country can take it. Another 4 years of Bushnomics.
All right, so you're optimistic that there's enough people out there who understand that really a full generation of Reagan ideological rule, and I include Clinton in that period, has been a disaster, and that they've squandered their political capital to the degree that Obama will be able to successfully forge some kind of national unity around an at least somewhat progressive agenda.
Yes, I do feel that hopefully will occur. You know, that saner heads will prevail, and that I think they'll give him a chance, because we're in such a deep hole that it's going to take, you know, it took a long period of time to get in this hole. It's going to take as long, if not longer, period to get out of it.
Okay, well, I hope you're right in terms of what the popular reaction out there in white rural America is going to be. Let's see if we can get another call. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down the radio and speak up.
This reminds me of 1980, when New York and the farmers were both going through a period where they had to get financing to buy their apartments because they were so expensive in New York. At the same time, the farmers were losing their land, so taking out giant loans by the banks, of course, growing what the banks told them to grow. And there was an independent candidate running to the rescue. A lot of the money.
I'm sorry, independent candidate? Who is the independent candidate?
That wacko who was running on the under the Democratic ticket. He was running under the independent ticket in 80. Later on, he was running under the Democratic ticket. I'd rather not
say his
name.
No, say his name.
I don't want to say his name.
Say his name. Who do you mean?
The guy who Ramsey Clark defended at one time in 1986. And he was running on an independent ticket.
Hang on. Are you talking about Lyndon LaRouche?
Of course.
He was never running on the Democratic ticket.
You want to make a bet? The last two times he ran into Lyndon LaRouche for Democrat, the first time it was an independent ticket. He called himself a Democrat. I'm telling you the truth, Bill. All right, so anyway, and what I'm saying is that your fear of what could happen about these kind of militia groups springing up is not paranoia, because at the same time that people were buying their apartments and having a hard time at the beginning of Reaganomics here, in 1980, the farmers were getting loans, bank loans, to rescue their farms. Of course, you have to pay those loans back, so you're pretty much indebted to whatever bank probably.
Right, and in fact, you know, the farm crisis of the 1980s was a real sort of an incubator for the radical right, because it was the Posse Comitatus which moved in and started providing the ideological background for a lot of farmers who actually resisted foreclosure, you know, against the banks during that period. And that sort of kept that was sort of like a bridge between the old Klan right of the previous decades and the new militia right, which followed in the 1990s.
Well, what bank is benefiting now from rescuing, or what banking corporation is rescuing everybody now from all these foreclosures? Is Citicorp having anything to do with that?
I don't really know.
Wouldn't be surprised.
I'm not sure anybody's being rescued yet. Who's being rescued? Well, what's your point behind that question anyway?
Well, because I believe, I don't have the facts on this, but at the time that all these loans were coming out for people buying their apartments and saving their farms.
Yes, point.
That Citibank had a lot to do with that at that time.
Well, I'm sure they did.
And yeah. They were the leaders of it.
Yeah, and they're also the big winners in the recent reshuffle that we just saw.
That's what I was just asking you. Yeah. Who was the big recent winner? And you said you didn't know. That's what I was saying.
Well, yeah, but you said, yeah, but that's a different, that's not the question that you asked.
I just asked who was benefiting.
Right. Who was benefited from the reshuffling that we just saw? Well, yes, Bank of America and Citibank.
There you go.
The two big winners.
All right.
Okay.
Bye.
Yeah. Okay. WBAI, you're on the air.
Good morning, Bill.
Hi.
Hey, I just wanted to tell you about the Sean Hannity so-called freedom concerts. That has been going on for about 5 years now. And another person involved in that is G. Gordon Liddy.
That's right. Yeah.
And also, people should take note that they do a lot of these things at the Six Flags amusement parks. So there's some kind of connection between whoever owns the Six Flags amusement parks and those concerts. Another thing, I believe that the persecution of undocumented workers in the country is only going to get really worse because of the loss of jobs, and people are really going to blame the undocumented workers for the fact that they can't even find, after they've lost maybe fairly well-paying jobs, even minimum wage jobs.
Well, certainly, you know, that threat exists, and I share your concerns. Just playing devil's advocate, on the other hand, you don't think that it's at least possible that if Obama, for starters, if he calls off the ICE raids, that could sort of begin to turn that whole sort of political narrative around, so to speak. Because even though, you know, of course, the Bush administration is not, you know, openly endorsing attacks on immigrants any more than the Berlusconi administration is in Italy. Similarly, their policies have sort of, you know, set that political narrative in place of, you know, scapegoating, poor immigrants for job loss here. And the way they've been doing that is through these ICE raids, you know, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So if Obama gets into office and stops the ICE raids first and foremost, that might be a good precedent of using the bully pulpit, so to speak, to...
I don't believe it. Just listen to the same people you were just talking about, Sean Hannity and all those people. I think they're the ones that are going to keep pumping this up.
Well, sure they will, but it's a question. But it's a question of what's going to play into their hands and what's going to marginalize them.
I think the Klan's going to grow. I think that there's going to be an upsurge in the type of neo-Nazi Ku Klux Klan type groups. Tend to grow bigger in poor economic conditions, and especially with a black president. I mean, you know, I'm from the South. I spent a lot of time growing up in areas that are heavy Klan areas, and I actually believe the Klan is probably pretty happy about Obama getting elected because they're going to get a lot of new members, and I think that's going to happen.
Well,
we need to watch out for that.
Believe me, I agree that we need to watch out for it, and I certainly share your concerns. On the other hand, I'll point out that in the 1930s, it went the other way. And in the 1930s, it wasn't the Posse Comitatus, but it was the Communist Party, which was organizing farmers to resist foreclosure and so on.
Yeah.
So...
we'll see what happens.
We'll see what happens.
I'm not very optimistic. All right, bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, hi, I had a comment. Actually, this is my first time listening into your show, so I wasn't sure what the content was going to be.
Uh-huh.
But this is my feeling. My feeling is this. Obviously, I'm a black woman of Caribbean descent. My feeling is this. Obviously, there's a lot of people who are not yet comfortable with that idea, but I do think the majority of Americans in general are kind of centered, meaning, yes, maybe in private they think a certain way and they act a certain way, but I think people are beginning to see that these ideas have to die out. They don't serve us, you know, thinking that, you know, someone's not qualified because of the color of their skin or that immigrants are taking jobs or whatever silly idea that people hide behind to sort of feel like, you know, it's them against us. I think those ideas, they're going to die. They don't serve us. And if you can see what's happening right now with in Los Angeles, where people are trying to overturn the whole gay marriage thing, I think our country is going to have some time of friction because these ideas are so new. But
okay, what's your point about the gay marriage controversy in California? How does that?
I just think it just goes to show in a state like California that's supposed to be very progressive politically, very sort of centered on lots of issues,
mm-hmm.
where people voted against that. I think it shows us, yes, the country, we still have a lot of work to do, but I think there's a slight majority of people that are very comfortable in saying, you know, these ideas have to die out. They don't serve us.
Oh, well, the California results would indicate the opposite. Your optimism is heartening, so I appreciate that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I just think it's just a matter of ideas have to move forward. I mean, when you think about the Sean Hannitys and all these other guys, of course, they're like fringe people. I don't think the majority of Americans would openly say they agree with these ideas. It doesn't make sense for us. We should get, I mean, I think we're past that. The majority of these ugly things that you call ugly America, I think they still exist, but I think in a minority, of course you're going to hear about these guys because they get attention. Every time they do something stupid, they get attention. I do think a slight majority of Americans are kind of centered and very open-minded, and my hope is that, you know, with this sort of newness that we're feeling, it's going to sort of like give us a period of sort of movement, where everybody gets swept up into this whole, you know, I don't know what the word is, like this whole sort of like brother and sister movement that everybody's feeling, like we're all one, we're all Americans. Maybe I'm naive, but I think that's going to give us a sort of like, at least for some period of time, give Obama and lots of Democrats the opportunity to put things in place and to try to fix this country.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you.
Turn down the radio and speak up.
Yes, I want to talk about those hate shows, the right-wing talk shows, but I also want to bring up the fact that an almost forgotten American hero, Elijah Lovejoy, a minister, I think, who was a printer, published anti-slavery literature for the abolitionists in St. Louis in the 1830s, moved up to Alton, Illinois, a little bit up the river, Mississippi, after three of his presses were destroyed, and then a fourth one was, and they shot him, they assassinated him, that is a pro-slavery mob, Elijah Lovejoy. Okay, I've listened for a long time to those programs, Hannity and a whole bunch of others, because I think we need to keep our ears open. They vary. They have some things in common and in various ways. They're different and they don't always agree among themselves. And beginning around mid-August, another such station opened up in addition to OR and ABC, about halfway between CBS AM and WINS, a news station. You can find it and see the array of people. Now, I think that there's veiled and more subtle racism among some of these people, but I think that if we try to get a call in with information of our background.
Right, so you want to infiltrate the...
Well, you could say that I hear occasional progressive people who...
Calling in just to make their voice heard? Okay, we'll think that over. Thank you very much. I'm going to try to move on, squeeze in a couple of more calls. WBAI, you're on the air. Turn down the radio and speak up. You're on the air. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. I feel as though there's two... Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I feel as though there's two sides to your paranoia, because I kind of agree with you.
Oh, well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, I am too, kind of, because I've been feeling this way for a while. But my thing is, everybody knows the history of America. America loves to eat its young, you know? So... The one side it is, it's very hopeful that America can sort of correct its past by electing Obama for president. But the sad thing is the preceding stuff that that's been happening since the election with the guns and...
Yes, it's ominous. It's ominous.
It's a very sad thing, and my thing is, I don't think America is ready for the repercussions of an action of Obama getting killed.
Let's not even talk about that. Please don't even invoke that.
But
all right.
The thing, that's the reality of the situation, because if America can be a hopeful place where it can change the whole aspect of racial relations and everything and elect a black man as president of the United States, and then again, a lone person or government involvement or whatever happens that snuffs them out, then eventually the hopeful people and the people that actually want to be together and want to have a future that, I guess, be together and
all right,
love.
Let's, all right, okay, I'm going to try to squeeze in one more call. Thank
you. Know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, believe me, it's something we've all thought about. I'm reluctant to even mention it out loud. But WBAI, you're on the air, probably our last call. Make it
learn,
a good one.
Learn to run the board, no dead air.
WBAI, you're on the air.
Hi. The definition of paranoia is the unreasoning fear of a non-existent threat. The threat is real, and you are not paranoid. That's number one. But maybe I am. You said something very recently that kind of encapsulated, put his finger on something. You referred to the last full generation of Reaganomics, including Clinton. I can't help but think that the manner in which this election took place and the campaign took place gave a clear indication of what this people, this country, really want. And that's why I'm a little puzzled that the early returns, the early information regarding his choices for cabinet members, both as supporting members and as, like, a Secretary of State, seem to be leaning toward Clinton alumnus or a member of the Clintons themselves. I know he's not naive. I know he's not a novice. He knows what he's doing. The fact that he got elected proved that, which makes me more puzzled about the direction his decisions seem to be headed.
All right, well, I gave you one optimistic theory at the top of the show if you were listening, right?
I missed that part.
Oh, well, some people are arguing that he, you know, he's trying to woo over potential rivals and get them on his side so that they'll be, you know, on board with his program rather than in opposition, and he can sort of play them and co-opt them and rebuild national unity by appealing to as many factions as possible so as to completely alienate ultimately the Christian right and the neocons and et cetera.
That makes a lot of sense. Let's hope it's true.
Exactly.
And time will tell.
Exactly.
Thanks
all right
for the show, man.
Thank
Thanks
you
for the time. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Let's squeeze in one more call since we can. WBAI, you're on the air. Make it quick and snappy. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yeah, Bill, you use that term, you'll consider taking phone
That's
calls.
Right.
That's one of the reasons.
That's right. I will consider taking phone calls. WBAI, you're on the air.
Bill, I'm glad I got through as probably the last caller. I just want to say very quickly, you know, I think
please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.